This is the weekly podcast from the Journal of Neurosurgery, featuring synopses of articles published online this week. Also this week, listen to our special interest podcast, a 12-minute interview with Dr. Kevin Lee of the University of Virginia. Subscribe in iTunes to get all JNSPG podcasts delivered straight to you.
Hello, and welcome to the Journal of Neurosurgery podcast for December 4th, 2009. I'm Margie Shreve.
And I'm Chris Gavin.
We will be reading synopses of two laboratory investigations, two clinical articles, and two case reports, all of which were published online today by the Journal of Neurosurgery. Accompanying the following laboratory investigation is a special interest podcast featuring an interview with senior author Kevin Lee. The article is titled Protection Against Focal Ischemic Injury to the Brain by Transsodium Crocitinate, and it was written by Hiroki, Manabe, and colleagues. Ischemic injury to the brain is a major complication associated with neurological disease, trauma, and surgery. Most experimental approaches to limiting ischemic injury try to either suppress metabolism or block mechanisms of cellular damage. The authors of this study took a different approach by attempting to modify the ischemic event itself. They used a novel compound, transsodium crocitinate, to enhance the delivery of oxygen to the brain during an ischemic event. The study demonstrates that this approach can reduce ischemic brain damage substantially and significantly. This novel approach, termed metabolic reflow, could be of value in other disorders in which ischemic injury plays a role.
The next laboratory investigation is titled A Pilot Study of Fat Allograft Transplantation in Immunocompetent Rabbits for Potential Neurosurgical Applications. It was written by John S. Kuo and colleagues. The use of fat grafts for repair of CSF leaks is a proven, well-tolerated technique, but it requires at least one extra incision and additional risks for patients. In this study, the authors examined the feasibility of using processed fat allografts instead. Because human fat is readily available, an undesirable adipose tissue is frequently removed and discarded. Successful tissue grafting usually requires either reduction of the graft's immunogenic properties or active postoperative immunosuppression in recipients. Using an immunocompetent rabbit model, Dr. Kuo and colleagues showed that fat allografts that had been pretreated to minimize host immune response were incorporated into wounds similarly to control fat autografts. Treated fat grafts showed incorporation rates that were similar to or better than autografts at all time points up to 11 weeks after surgery. In contrast, untreated fat allografts incited an acute immune response and adjacent host tissue showed damage. Fat that is processed to remove infectious and antigenic factors can be banked as a convenient and possibly inexpensive resource for surgical applications. Future work extending to fat processing, storage, and validation of wound healing in humans will be required before clinical application is possible.
This clinical article is titled Fluid-Fluid Level in Pituitary Tumors, Analysis of Management of 106 Cases. It is written by Atul Goel and co-authors. In pituitary tumors, a fluid level within a fluid cavity, referred to as the fluid-fluid level, is rarely reported but is not uncommon, particularly in cases of large or giant tumors. The authors treated 1,660 pituitary tumors between 2000 and 2009. Reviewing these cases, they identified 106 tumors in which one or more fluid levels were present. The majority of these patients presented with worsening vision. Their symptoms were insidious in onset and progressed gradually. In such cases, surgery is relatively straightforward despite the large size of the lesions. After surgery, visual dysfunction resolved in 94% of patients who had presented with a visual deficit. Visual recovery in these patients suggests that the fluid level in pituitary tumors forms a pressure cyst that grows over time. Unlike most pituitary tumors, the tumor adjoining the cyst in these cases was hypervascular and friable. The pattern of clinical presentation and visual recovery following surgery suggests that acute hemorrhage and subsequent resorption of the clot were the primary causative factors for the fluid level. It appears that these tumors are more aggressive in their clinical behavior than was previously believed. Compared to other pituitary tumors, recurrence rates are relatively higher, and recovery of hormonal function is less reliable in such cases.
The case report, a partially ossified solid and cystic Rathke cleft cyst, was written by Yoshikazu Ogawa and colleagues. A Rathke cleft cyst arises from the remnants of an improperly formed Rathke pouch, which develops into a mucus-filled cyst. Magnetic resonance imaging characteristically shows a thin, membranous cystic wall as well as homogeneous intensity of the content, suggesting fluid collection. Cases of irregular, thickened, or calcified cyst wall are rare. The 21-year-old woman, in this case, presented to the hospital with a serious visual field defect. Magnetic resonance imaging showed a massive solid cellar lesion extending upward, compressing the optic chiasm and floor of the third ventricle. The lesion was totally removed through the transphenoidal route, and the patient experienced immediate recovery in visual function. Postoperative histological examination disclosed that the major part of the lesion consisted of various phases of clotting and granulation with significant fibrosis. Mature bone formation and abundant cholesterol clefts were also seen. Single cuboidal epithelium was found along this granulation, and the diagnosis was established as a Rathke cleft cyst. Bone formation of a Rathke cleft cyst is extremely rare, and a solid Rathke cleft cyst has not previously been encountered. This case illustrates the extremely long and complex nature of this disease.
This clinical article is titled Interdisciplinary Treatment of Ruptured Cerebral Aneurysms in Elderly Patients. It was written by Francois Proust and colleagues. Improved health and longer life expectancy account for the significant numbers of elderly patients admitted with subarachnoid hemorrhage. Despite the morbidity risk related to aneurysm obliteration in this patient group, which has a higher rate of comorbidity, age is not a sufficient reason to refuse treatment. The authors assess the clinical conditions at onset, neurological deterioration after treatment, and overall outcome in 64 consecutive elderly patients. Both microsurgical clipping and endovascular coiling were used in an interdisciplinary context. A neurovascular interdisciplinary team jointly discussed the early obliteration procedure for each aneurysm. At 6 months, the outcome was favorable in 39 of the 64 patients. In a multivariate regression logistic analysis, the authors determined that age exceeding 75 years, poor initial clinical grade, and the development of ischemia were independent factors associated with unfavorable outcome. The baseline characteristics of subarachnoid hemorrhage in the elderly were only slightly different from those of younger patients. However, the interdisciplinary approach may be considered useful in the elderly in order to decrease ischemic consequences.
Next, we have a case report by Bulent Baltacci et al. Titled Cardiac Arrest After Intracisternal Papaverine Instillation During Intracranial Aneurysmal Surgery. Cerebral vasospasm induced by aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage is still a leading cause of morbidity and death. The intracisternal application of papaverine for vasospasm is common after craniotomy for an aneurysm. Nevertheless, the intraarterial or intracisternal administration of papaverine is associated with various complications, such as mydriasis, confusion, seizure, reversible brainstem depression, hypotension, tachycardia, and thrombocytopenia. The 50-year-old man in this case was found unconscious and brought to the emergency department. A CT scan revealed diffuse subarachnoid hemorrhage with hyperdensity in the fourth ventricle and subarachnoid spaces. Digital subtraction angiography confirmed the presence of an aneurysm at the communicating segment of the left internal carotid artery. Surgery to clip the aneurysm was planned on post-subarachnoid hemorrhage day 8. After a left tyrionyl craniotomy, the aneurysm was clipped and papaverine was topically applied to the surgical area. Although the patient was hemodynamically stable throughout the 120 minutes of surgery, bradycardia and hypotension suddenly developed after the instillation of papaverine. After 60 minutes of CPR, the patient was declared deceased. The use of intracisternal papaverine administration before closure of the dura after aneurysm clipping has been used to prevent vasospasm. Although the exact mechanism of papaverine side effects is not clear, several different mechanisms have been suggested, such as primary toxic or neurodepressive effects of the papaverine itself, secondary embolic or ischemic effects associated with precipitate formation, and brainstem or hypothalamic dysfunction. The application of papaverine to the surgical area led to fatal bradycardia and hypotension in this case. The cause was not clear. These events could be associated with stimulation of the hypothalamus or vagal nucleus, or with brainstem depression. The authors wish to emphasize that the anesthetist should be vigilant in communication with the surgical team and aware of the papaverine volume, concentration, and temperature to appropriately manage any life-threatening event.
Thank you for listening. To read all the articles published by the JNSPG this week, or to listen to more podcasts from the Journal of Neurosurgery or Neurosurgical Focus, please visit us at thejns.org.